Welcome to the Swiss Money Secrets Podcast, a podcast designed to cover all things offshore investing and banking from the Swiss perspective.
Let's get into it.
At the end of the day, how we set ourselves apart is by building relationships. And we put in a lot of time and effort to make sure that every relationship manager we have has an amount of clients that he or she can manage, that we don't overburden our relationship managers with too many clients. So for now, currently, we have about 35 to 40 clients per relationship manager, whereas with a larger bank, that usually goes up to the hundreds or sometimes even thousands, depending on the size of the client. So we have certain minimum investment sizes, but with that, we can ensure that we only have as many clients that we can actually know in person. So if a client calls us, we know them, we know who they are, we know about their spouses and children and their careers, and that's really important to us. I mean, as a company, again, it's what sets us apart, but also for me as a human being, I enjoy most being in touch with other human beings and learning about their stories, learning about their values. So I think, yeah, it's absolutely key to what we do.
I totally agree with what James said, and I think there are so many aspects to the relationship building process with the clients. It's much more than just performance. I mean, of course, performance is important and you should really make the money for your client, but you should also take your client on board on the journey of like growing and developing your wealth. So for me, it is really important to get the client to a point where he or she feels comfortable with the whole setup, he's comfortable with the investments we do.
I think that's so important, especially also what you said about the portfolios. I mean, we need to know our clients to actually build those individualized portfolios, right? So we don't have just like a one-size-fits-all fund strategy and we just sell the same fund to every client. We make direct investments, and in order to pick the right investments and sell at the right time, we need to know what are our clients looking to achieve. As we said, what is their risk tolerance? What is their willingness to be involved? We have some clients who are extremely hands-off and they say, hey, I pay you to manage this for me so I don't have to take care of it. So maybe we only speak once a year with them. But then we also have clients who utilize us as like an education provider, if you so will. We have some clients that want to learn through us, that want to pick our brains and see the thought process behind. Sometimes we also have contact with one family member that has very good knowledge, and then maybe a child or a spouse who is not as well versed, and then we're also happy to take them on board. So I think that's really what we pride ourselves is in, that we look at every client and at every family, look what they need and how they want to hear from us. Some people prefer a video meeting, some people prefer a telephone call, some also just want to hear or from us over email, and we adhere to that. And I think that's also important that clients understand that our way of communication is also individualized to what they want.
I assume that we will probably see it very similarly, because as financial professionals, it's very important for me, and I think also for like Switzerland as a country, to not be a place for like that attracts criminals and that attracts people that want to finance terrorism or launder money. I mean, we have no interest in attracting those kinds of people. Same. But at the same time, there's very reasonable desires for privacy protection. And that's something that, as you said, sometimes privacy protection can be, if it is not there, it can be a risk to your life or to the life of your loved ones, depending on which jurisdiction you reside in. Switzerland's slow approach is quite sustainable. It's good because we don't want to be the first movers. We want to make sure that we see what works, what doesn't work. As we saw, like with the developments in Europe, I mean, if you're too quick in doing something and then it doesn't work out, you have to take a few steps back. That's also not great. So I think Switzerland is doing the best as it can in terms of complying, while at the same time really just doing the bare minimum to comply, to make sure that we don't have any illegal activities here, and at the same time still prioritizing the privacy needs of our clients.
I also think that we will have to see how in practice it works. From a trustee point of view, what I can say is that it will be a register of companies, of beneficial owner of companies. So trustees will not be directly affected by it, for the simple reason that a trust is not a company, it's not a legal entity, plus there is no Swiss trust. So the trustees will not have any obligations under the new law, except if a trust managed by a Swiss trustee, or any other trustee for that matter, owns a Swiss company, the trustee will have to notify the company directors of who the beneficial owners of the trust will be.
But to clarify, if a trust opens up a bank account in Switzerland, irrespective
yes.
of whether the trustee is a Swiss trustee, an American trustee, wherever they're at,
correct.
The beneficial owners would still have to be in this central register, correct?
No, because there we talk about the anti-money laundering provisions.
Okay.
The new law, the draft bill that is going to be drafted about the central register of beneficial owners of Swiss companies,
okay.
that is something separate from that. So all the duties that we have, be it trustees, be it banks, in identifying beneficial owners remain exactly the same. What
okay.
changes is, under the current law, the companies have to keep this internal register of beneficial owners. Now that internal company held beneficial owner register will be somehow put into a central register.
Mm-hmm. In the US, it was really more of a liquidity crisis, of a liquidity issue. So it was a misjudgment of the interest rate development. So what the bank basically has to do, they have to hold part of the funds in very liquid and very safe assets, which their clients deposit with them. And due to the regulation, government bonds are also counted as the most safe assets. But due to the increase of interest rates by the Federal Reserve of about 4.5% within 12 months, if you haven't had hedged or insured the interest rate risk, that could have led to a problem, and that was exactly what happened to the Silicon Valley Bank. So people started to withdraw money, so they had to sell their investments because they didn't have enough cash, and they had to sell the investments with a discount, so they experienced a loss. And when it came out, it turned into a trust crisis as well, where more and more people said, okay, I don't want to be the last one. And eventually, even if you gave your transfer order on Thursday evening, it wasn't executed anymore to the next day. And this was where the FDIC,
mm-hmm.
I think,
yeah.
stepped in and took over. And then eventually, also over the weekend, 1 week earlier than with Credit Suisse, the Fed and the U.S. government decided that all the deposits are insured, even so usually it will only be 250,000. And the thing now is that people already have some kind of a mistrust against the banking sector, because from the great financial crisis, if it goes well, the bankers, they profit. If it goes bad, the government steps in, and eventually the taxpayer. And so, a lot of people do not understand how exactly a bank is structured and what risks are involved and where they are located in the structure, that leads to a situation where people took their money and going to the biggest institutions they can find, thinking, okay, if at all, the government has to save them, so I will be better off to have my money with them. And yeah, so turning it up to, or like going into the Swiss financial system, here it really is about Credit Suisse. So we also saw when people started to withdraw money from Credit Suisse, I mean, all the private banks, which really focus on serving their clients with their custody services, they did not have an issue or a problem.
So how would you assess how Switzerland fares in terms of innovation compared to an international level? My understanding is that it continuously ranks quite high. I'm not sure if this is correct, and if it is, why that's the case. And maybe you can share a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So you are totally correct, Jamie. So in terms of innovation, for the 12 years in a row, Switzerland is ranked as the first and most innovative country in the world on the Global Innovation Index. So that's very good. And the reason can be seen in different aspects. So you have top research centers, top university. Here in Zurich, we have ETH, in Lausanne, EPFL, but you have also other research centers where essentially these innovation and technologies are brought. So we rank pretty high. But of course, what's different is the way this type of innovation is nurtured by investors. So that's something we can still do some work in this respect. So of course, it also depends when you talk about innovation. For example, Switzerland is always very high when you look at the number of patents. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the criteria on this innovation index. So it's good to have a lot of patent filing. Of course, this also brings and is a reason because we have a lot of pharma companies mm-hmm. and so on. But having patent per se doesn't necessarily mean having successful business or being able to, you know, create companies that can scale. And maybe we can look at differences in that respect from Switzerland compared to other countries.
So in Switzerland, I mean, as everywhere in the world, during Corona, there was a lot of discussions about like moving more into digital payments and getting rid of cash more and more, and that is something which people could also see in the behavior of central banks, where they did some research how they could introduce central bank digital currencies. It's a huge issue or a huge term, and so there was a group of people in Switzerland that they said, we don't want that, we want to be sure that for the future that we will always have the choice between what we use, whether it's cash or whether it's like a credit card or whatever. And so they came up with a referendum to make sure that we can implement that into our constitution. In Switzerland, it works in a way that you have to collect signatures from about 100,000 people, and then they have to be brought in front of a judge who makes sure that everything's right, every signature is valid, and then this referendum goes to the government, and they have to turn it into an election where the people in Switzerland can decide whether they want to have this step taken on to implement this guarantee of cash into our constitution.
I think on like a broad level, and we have spoken about that before when we were preparing this podcast, Switzerland is quite a conservative country in a lot of aspects, and cash payment is one of them. So I was quite surprised actually to see the actual numbers. I knew that the cash was quite prevalent here, but I've read that 97% of Swiss people still use cash or have cash at home, and over 70%, I believe, of the transactions are made in cash. So especially for people who are 55 years old and older, this is still the most popular means of payment. And I think for me personally, I think it is important to have the option to pay with cash. I have to admit that I pay cashless most of the time, but I like to have the option. I don't think that the government should take this right away from people. I mean, it is a very slippery slope into a huge loss of privacy. The potential of surveillance is huge, and I think that's always something to be careful of. This particular initiative or referendum, I think personally, I think it's good that we have the right democracy. I think it's good that we are able to put those referendums forward. And I think this specific case, they collected over 160,000 signatures in the 18-month time limit that they had, which definitely means it should be taken seriously as a way forward in politics. I personally don't think it's currently really necessary because, yes, the fears are here from some people, but again, like if 97% of people use cash and have cash, I'm not sure if there is an actual need today to write it into the constitution. But if a majority of Swiss people feel that it is necessarily, why not do it? And I mean, it might be a necessity some point down the road, so why not make those rules now?
So one of the most common misconceptions about offshore trust is that you can use them to avoid or evade paying income taxes. And if that could be done legally, you could avoid income taxes. I would have flown over my private jet here, but no, you cannot use an offshore trust to avoid income taxes. What you can, the way a trust is structured is it's tax neutral. It does not increase your taxes. It does not decrease your taxes. There are certain IRS reporting requirements you must complete if you have an offshore trust or an offshore bank account. And in doing so, we provide our clients a detailed tax memorandum, which they can share with their CPA to show them how to complete the offshore reporting requirements. Or we have a network of CPAs we work with that we can refer our clients to complete those reporting requirements. It does not increase your chance of an audit the way the IRS calculates whether they're going to audit someone. Reporting that you have an offshore trust is not going to increase your chance of an audit because that's an active.
China and the US are, trying to decouple of each other, not only economically, but then of course also politically, is certainly something that is shaping very much the global landscape. But of course there are many other conflicts, we just don't talk about them. Yeah, when I hear BRICS, I hear the 90s calling. So this is, I think the BRICS was coined by a US investment strategist, I think it was a colleague at Goldman Sachs, if I remember correctly. So Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. So the five emerging economies at the time, and he labeled them, kind of put them all into the same basket and said, well, you know, we do not only have the major US economy and the major maybe European economy, but there are also other newly emerging markets that will grow so much that they will basically be able to compete with the established markets in the near future. And actually, for some of these markets, it was not that wrong to make that statement, right? I think China has outgrown a bit this BRICS status, I would say. I mean, China is now clearly the second largest economy on this planet, and has also, of course, caught up with, has not caught up with the US, not by far, but still is, you know, getting closer in terms of economic power, in terms of military power, etc. But some of these countries have also developed a bit in the reverse direction. When you look at Russia, I think Russia is a country in steep decline, economically, militarily, not sure. when we look at the Ukraine war, many people thought before the war that they would just, that it would be a matter of weeks or maybe a month or two until they get hold of Ukraine, and it didn't prove to be the case. And India, of course, is now, I think, when it comes to population, the largest country in the world. So there you see very divergent trends among these regional powers. These are regional powers, also Brazil, of course, for South America. But I do not really see exactly what their common interests are. What is really the bond that would kind of tie these countries together? So I think, of course, these countries will play an important role also going forward, but I do not think that the BRICS label or this club, they have even formed it into a club then later on. It's interesting, right? So an American investment strategist coined the term, and then this term was picked up by these powerful nations, and they even built a club around it, but I do not think that this is a club that has a strong internal cohesion so that it's also able then to actually shape something on the global political scene. But the countries for themselves individually, of course, they remain important important economic and important political players, if not globally, then certainly in their respective regions.
US dollar has been losing value for a long time, even without being challenged just by their domestic developments, by how the Fed has positioned itself, by how the politicians have positioned themselves. And now we also have this external pressure where we have other countries that, I mean, if we look at GDP numbers, if we look at population numbers, even if you look at GDP growth, I mean, the BRICS countries, even just the initial five, have surpassed the G7 countries. And then another topic that has come up again and again by our clients is this rumor or like this idea that the BRICS nations are going to start their own trading currency that will be backed by gold that is going to challenge the US dollar as a reserve currency. So I think those are the two main changes that we have been seeing in the past 18 months or so that make the BRICS nations really a relevant topic for international investors, a relevant topic for people in the US and Europe, the rest of the world, which I think it's important to cover, or we see which direction we see those countries take. Maybe one or the most notable information or news update that came out of the meeting was the addition of six other countries. So I guess people will have to find a new acronym, BRICS Plus maybe, I don't know. So we are now looking at 11 countries. And for me personally, and I don't want to fall into it too long of a monologue, but I'm a little bit missing the commonalities between the countries, because that was already not so given with the five initial countries, or it was four plus South Africa that joined a year later. But now with the 11 countries, it seems like the most common denominator is their either distrust or dislike of the US or the West in general. But even that is not really the case with everyone. India, for example, has very close relationships with the US. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how exactly they're going to position themselves, because I think it's important to say what you stand for and not define yourself by what you stand against.
Yeah, that makes totally sense. But I think that it also makes sense to build kind of a counterweight to the Western economies and what they are trying to achieve. And so with the biggest issue with the BRICS states is that they were trying to do it better than the West. And now they have these main contributors to the BRICS, which are Brazil, China, and so on. And they will have the main decision power on the whole organization.
Yeah, but I mean, so the BRICS is a sort of counterweight to the G7, right? Which is the US, Canada, some European countries, and then Japan. And they are sort of like bound together through like a common value system, which I don't see with the BRICS countries. So they cannot agree on a political system. They cannot agree on a value system. They cannot really agree on spending, and they are also vastly different when it comes to GDP per capita. So with the developed countries, we see, of course, it's all individual countries, they're all slightly different, but they have like an overarching similarity. And with the BRICS countries, I don't really see that. And they also, like, the one thing, the distrust of the West, or like having this counterpart to the West, this is also not really given, because, for example, with Vladimir Putin, the head of Russia, being invited or essentially uninvited from the summit, South Africa didn't want to make the West mad, because they agreed to the international court. So they would have had to arrest Putin. And even if they didn't arrest Putin, there was still this threat of them losing 10% of their GDP from the West if they would have not arrested him, and if there would have been placed sanctions on the country. So they are still somewhat dependent on the West. They're not really, so I struggle a bit with the concept.
Yeah, I do see your point, but it does take time until something has been achieved. I mean, the main point, or one of the main points, is or are the sanctions from the West. Because with the sanctions, there is so much frustration, because the Western countries, especially the US with the US dollar, they have so much power over the payment system that they can ruin or like destroy a whole country economically. And I think there it is a good development that there will be another system where these countries can flee to. And I don't say that countries shouldn't be punished if they do something wrong. I think there should be international pressure on these countries if there is something where like the majority of the countries around the globe agree that it is wrong. And I think that is also something with with Russia. I mean, what happened before Russia invaded Ukraine? I mean, that's kind of a different story, and there was a lot of discussion about that. But at the moment, all the suffering which is going on in Ukraine, nobody really supports that. And so I think that also puts South Africa in a place where they say, okay, on one side we agree with the values of the Western world, but on the other side we don't want to be that tied or that connected to the Western world anymore.
Yeah, I understand that. But I mean, what you alluded to with Russia, I think one of the main problems one of the problems was that the US kicked Russia out of the SWIFT system, right? Mm-hmm. And now with the East or this anti-West coalition, they are building a sort of like counterweight to that, and China has its own payment system and all of that. And of course, you can have a discussion whether or not it's correct to politicize an international payment system like SWIFT. I don't think our personal opinions on that matter too much, but the question is, where do you put your trust, right? And who says that China would not politicize a payment system that they have? So I think they would do exactly the same. And that's also a little bit of an issue I have. The BRICS country say the West is hypocritical, and that's certainly true to an extent. But the same goes for the BRICS country, because what they point their finger towards the West, towards things that the US has done, other countries have done in the past that wasn't right. But they're doing the same things, right? So.
But I think that's a positive on a multipolar system, that you have an alternative.
So a debt brake is something that Americans may be unfamiliar about. It's something that's placed into the fiscal or into the regulation that the governments can't spend more than a certain percentage of their GDP. So maybe, Urs, you could explain a little bit more about how the debt break actually works in Switzerland, and then we can kind of discuss as a team how it differentiates versus a debt ceiling like what we have in the States.
Yeah, and I guess we haven't released what anniversary it is of the debt break. So it's the 20th. So 20 years ago, there was a vote, an election on this topic, and about 85% of the population voted for it. So that is really interesting, and it holds up very well. So how it actually works is, as you said, it's the debt, the spending in relation to the GDP, which gives enough flexibility that you can increase your spending if the economy does well, but also holds on or holds you responsible to not overspend just because you're in a good environment.
If I may jump in, I think it's the other way around. So you spend less when there's a good economic cycle, and then you can spend more when it's a bad economic cycle. So it's not that you spend more if it's a good year, it's that you save, essentially, like a household, you would put money away for harder times, just to make that clear for the audience.
Yeah, but if you're growing, you can still extend your spending, but not at the same pace as the GDP growth. And yes, of course, you have to put stuff or money away, liquidity away, so you have some kind of safety net. And then if the economy is for some reason decreases, then you can increase your debt for a certain time period, but then you have to save again when it becomes better. And so what is the range? It's or the threshold is about 40%. So that's the target. Sometimes it's a little bit above, sometimes a little bit below. And due to the mentality we are having in Switzerland, usually the forecasts, and I think we mentioned that in previous episodes, the forecasts usually are more negative than actually the outcome is. And so Switzerland did a really good job in saving up enough money and getting along this debt break.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned 85% of people in 2001 have voted for this, and then it was implemented in 2003, which is why we're now celebrating the 20-year anniversary. And to this day, this is really something that people agree on. I think a vast majority of people on the whole spectrum of like political parties agree with this concept of putting money away in the good times and then spending way more in the bad times, like you would do as an individual person. Where people then start to argue, of course, is when you don't have money for certain things because you're not allowed to overspend, and then people disagree on where you should save, etc. It's not, things are not perfect here, but I think they're a lot more sustainable. And then also what Urs mentioned is this flexibility of having it tied to the growth of the economy, and also having the options to spend more in certain extreme scenarios. So for example, 2020 and 2021, the government has been very supportive of the economy by spending a lot more money than what would have been like projected or like budgeted. But they are not just like extreming spending more, they are now also very, very thoroughly discussing how to pay the money back, essentially. So the plan is now to get all the extra spending of 2020 and 2021 paid back or saved back, essentially, until the year 2035. So I think that's very important, that people are not just flexible in increasing their spending, but they also are very serious about saying, okay, we now had to spend more than what we projected, so now we have to make sure that we spend a little less over the years to come to get that back into balance. And I think that's another thing where Switzerland is very different to its neighbor and a lot of other countries around the world, that we have a lot of like fiscal surpluses. So we really take money management seriously, not just in the financial industry, not just as individuals or households, but also at the government level.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people are not even aware of the option and the possibility, because it is complex, it doesn't involve a lot of moving parts, and I think we get to that later in the conversation as well, but I find it very important to talk to people about how they can move the significant chunk of their money that is in retirement plans, how they can move that to diversify outside of the US.
Yeah, I think the structure, the possibilities the US government created through these IRAs is quite astonishing, and I think it's a wonderful thing they did, because it gives you so much flexibility, it gives you like power to decide on your own wealth, not necessarily as long as it is in a 401k, then it's usually within solution to employer juices, but with an IRA you have a lot of possibilities, and you can also work with different tax structures, whether it's you mentioned Roth IRAs or traditional IRAs. And so I believe that it is a great way to work on your wealth as well, and I could also imagine that one reason why it represents about 75% of your total wealth are exactly these liberties or these possibilities you have. And there is a study which argues that this 25 to 35% Jamie mentioned reduces the volatility of your overall wealth structure. So if you have like all of your wealth in the US, you have usually a rather high volatility. I mean, there are great things in the US, there is a huge point to be invested in the US, but by just moving this 25 to 35% of your wealth offshore and diversify it globally, it can reduce your volatility by a big portion. And so this is one part of it. And then, I mean, the classical argumentation of not having all your eggs in one basket, you really want to be diversified, you want to have like assets in other currencies, in other geographical regions, which might not be as dependent to the US as if you would be directly in the US. I mean, for the same reasons, people also invest some of the IRA money, for example, in real estate. Or, I mean, as I said, the possibilities are very, very broad. And so there is a good reason to take one portion of it. Don't take all of it, but take one portion of it, move it offshore. We also have a lot of clients who combine it, who have like a portion of the IRAs and an individual account, or in the name of their family trust or offshore trust, whatever they have. So you can really plan and structure your wealth in a way where it makes sense.
I was listening to a report talking about data handlers even in the US, and how they just approach companies in the US and say, hey, here's an X amount of dollar of that we want to pay you for all of your clients' details.
Yeah.
No one has to know. And that's something that you can ensure by having working with Swiss private banks or financial institutions or wealth managers, that cannot happen They can certainly they can be approached, but it's punishable by law, jail time, hefty fines, you know, protecting the client's data and personal information, which I think is a big positive.
Absolutely. And on top of the law, I think it's also very ingrained in our culture. I think privacy protection, minding your own business, not sticking your nose into anyone else's business, that's a very Swiss way of living, and something that we learn and are socialized to do also from a very young age, even though if it wasn't like punishable by law, which it is, I think Swiss people are more private and more conservative than some people from other parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, to add on to that point, I mean, the Swiss Banking Privacy Act wasn't even introduced until the 30s, I believe, the 1930s.
Yeah.
And before, it was just the way it was their common practice of Swiss financial institutions. So I think that adds up to your point of it just being ingrained in the culture. And it's led Switzerland down a successful road as far as really taking the client serious and placing them first and ensuring that they are taken care of above all else, and taking on the risk as the person to make sure that they're protected as the company that's managing them.
Yeah.
And I wanna say to people where you might get afraid of these reporting things, maybe you're a U.S. citizen who's never actually lived in the U.S., you were born outside, you grew up outside, you're not connected, don't be afraid to get in contact with tax consultants to discuss these things and how to move forward. In these cases, when working with professionals, there's usually a good outcome. There's paperwork involved, but I've known a few people who've had to go through that process here in Switzerland, who had an American connection and never knew about it until they were in their mid-20s, late 20s, 30s. And they had to go through the work, but it was nothing that put them in jeopardy, nothing that put their passport in jeopardy. So there's a lot of fear that can come around it, but I think it's good to stay calm, seek out the professional help if you're in that situation. And if you're working with us or want to work with us, always ask questions about these things, and we can point you into the direction of tax specialists and tax attorneys and CPAs that have really good knowledge.
Absolutely.
So with that, do we have any final thoughts that we want to put in the episode, Jamie or Lewis?
Well, I think my final thoughts, just a summary, make sure that you understand the reporting requirements, make sure they work with professionals, but also make sure that you don't miss out on any opportunities just because they come with a little bit more paperwork.
I couldn't have said it better. No, it is really the case. I mean, there are quite a few people like... take a step back if they hear about, oh, then you have to do that on top of that. But you really can miss out on a lot if you don't go through that. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's not that hard.
Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Swiss Money Secrets podcast. If you would like to learn more about WHVP and what we do, check us out on our website at whvp.ch. Or you can check us out on any of our social media handles on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, or Instagram by simply searching WHVP. Have a great rest of your day.